You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest this week is Michael Nesmith. In addition to recording many albums as a solo artist and with the First National Band, Michael Nesmith created the video Elephant Parts and the TV series Television Parts. He is the producer whose movies include Repo Man. He's the author of several books, including The Prison, which had a soundtrack LP, and The Long Sandy Hair of Neftune Zamora. And he's just published an autobiography called Infinite Tuesday, an autobiographical riff. Michael Nesmith also wore a wool hat on a TV show called The Monkees. Mike Nesmith, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And recently, there was this 50th anniversary edition of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And among all the treasures to be found there was this music video, I guess a promotional film for A Day in the Life. It's this wacky little film, and you're in it. Can you tell us how you happened to be in that little film?
Well, that was a recording for the Sgt. Pepper's album, A Day in the Life, and I was invited by John. My wife and I were invited by John. I was actually staying with him at the time. I was out at his house. And he said, well, you know, come on over to the studio. And so we did, but, you know, most of London was there as well. I mean, it was kind of the rock hierarchy and aristocracy. And so the orchestra was there, that's on the record, and so forth, and cameras. And there we jolly well were. And there we jolly well were photographed.
Did you know you were going to be in this film?
I don't think I really understood the size of what was going on. I thought he was just that we were going to go over to where they were recording, and I somehow knew that there was going to be an orchestra there, but the word had gotten out, you know, that it was kind of a big session and that it was a drop-by session, and there were certain people were invited on the inner circle, so I kind of knew what was going on, but I didn't know the size of it or anything.
And you were staying at John Lennon's house.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's kind of cool, isn't it?
Well, it was. I mean, as far as staying at someone's house is, yeah. I mean, the English have a really good way of being and accepting house guests. So it was pleasant. They're much better house guests, I think, than almost anybody else in the world. I have a lot of English friends, and they always know the right time to show up and the right time to disappear, and they just make themselves a great house guests, and I learned it from the English and learned it from being invited there to different people's houses to stay. And, you know, when I first reached out to John and said I'd love to meet you, he said, well, come stay. You know, just as natural as that. And so I said, well, thank you for the invitation, I'll be right there.
I'll be right over. So there was the Monkees that really got you in the door. You know, the cast of Gilligan's Island, they were not expected to actually become castaways. And yet the cast of the Monkees actually became the Monkees.
Well, no, I don't think anybody expected us to do that either. but when the opportunity to perform became real, and we were all sitting around looking at, now what do we do? This television show about these four characters who were supposedly a starving band playing rock music, living on the beach, and kind of the happy-go-lucky life of a 20-year-old in Southern California. It got real. And so we had to get ourselves in a rehearsal room and start working on how are we going to play these records, and what are we going to do. And, of course, we weren't very good, but we weren't all that bad. We were very much like the garage band we were portraying. And so, from that standpoint, it worked out fine in terms of execution and the product. But what was fascinating to me was watching the thing come to life. It came to life in such a way that, you know, it's lasted for decades now.
Yeah.
And it's this strange capacity, I think, that television has to create the thing that it projects and purveys, and a lot of times they really do come to life. They come to life off of the the way the show is, especially now at reality television, and now that the moving images has migrated over to the computer screen and so on and so forth, this phenomenon, I think, is getting stronger and stronger. You're seeing, you're watching things actually happen real time, even when you're looking at them and you know they're set up and kind of a trick. You buy into it as being really happening. But back in the 60s, television wasn't anywhere near that sophisticated, and none of us knew we were going to stumble into this thing. So we just had been hired as actors to play these roles in this television show about an out-of-work rock and roll band living on the beach. But then there was this, please come and play live. Everybody wants to see you. So we said, okay, and we went to work, and we learned the songs, and wrote some more songs, and we recorded some songs as a band. And then we walked out on stage, and the crowd, you know, it was a 20,000 seat sports arena, and it was alive. Suddenly there it was, and you know, it became undeniable at that point.
Well, the fact that John Lennon invited you into his home would indicate that there was not only the general public, but that the rest of the rock and roll world didn't think anything less of the Monkees, in that they hadn't come together organically, like, say, the Byrds or the Buffalo Springfield.
Well, not so fast. I think I think there was a lot of opprobrium out there for us. There was a real pariahhood right after the show came out, right after the first record came out, and so forth. We finally did go into the studio, and we did record our own music and play it ourselves and put out our own album. That was an album called Headquarters, but it was the only one we made. There were a lot of things that were on the side of that happened in the flow around it, and so there were a few more albums that followed on after that. But in terms of just going into the studio and playing this thing, really the only record we made was Headquarters. Up till that point, we were dashed off as meaningless, as a fraud, some sort of conspiracy against the authentic rock and roll music. But of course, it wasn't rock and roll music. It was a television show. It wasn't the same thing as the Byrds, and it wasn't the same thing as Creedence and the Beatles and other big bands at the time. We weren't in that. It wasn't our métier. And we, the four of us, really had very little to say creatively. So we were doing a lot of what we were told to do and reading lines that we were given to read, or in some instances extemporizing lines. But it was, it was a rough ride, because nobody quite knew what to make of it. And some of the arbiters of hip and the arbiters of authenticity today's hipster world, they were saying, well, that's not real, but this is real, and that's not good, but this is good, and so forth. And we were on the brunt of that. We had the short stick in that deal. But once we started playing, in the concerts and so forth, there was a kind of a general feeling, and I had people stand as I was about to walk on stage with my guitar slung across my neck, ask me, where is the band that really plays? Is it under the stage? Is it behind the stage? and they just wouldn't let it go that this thing had really happened within the environs of television. Later, as people listened to the music, and when David and Mickey and Peter went out during the 70s and 80s, there was a great deal of love, and by that time, opprobrium had turned into approbation, and they were just—I saw one of the concerts, and they were, so loved. And the shows were great, and the crowd was loving it. And in my book, Infinite Tuesday, I write about all this because it's—I think it's one of the more fascinating elements of the way the Monkees came to light. The book is not about the Monkees, but it is very much about what you and I are talking about right now. The power of television to create its own space.
It does have pictures of monkeys repeatedly on the cover of the book.
Well, they're real monkeys.
So you're saying those monkeys are more real than... you did mention in your book, and you know, I think monkeys fans might be sad to hear that there was fist fights among. Were there actual fist fights among?
Well, I think you mischaracterized that a bit.
Oh.
They weren't really fist fights. They were, you know, playground fights. It was like I say in the book, you know, an entitled 8-year-old on a playground who takes umbrage at you know, some imagined insult, and you know, the slaps start or the pushes start and so forth. Of course, it's unnerving and it's upsetting and disturbing to see it, you know, among grown men.
Yeah.
You know, in their 20s, but nobody was hurt. It wasn't, you know, like a slugfest. It wasn't a raging bull. It was just, you know, it was playground fights. I never did it. I'm not a hitter. I never was. You know, it would just erupt from time to time.
Did it kind of burn you personally when people criticized the monkeys for not playing on their instruments, on their records, when at the same time all those groups, the mamas and the papas and the birds and everybody, had the exact same musicians that played on Monkees and more of the Monkees playing on their record?
No, it didn't annoy me, but it was, you know, it was a symptom of ignorance. I knew that they didn't know, people didn't understand how music was produced, and that, you know, very often there were a lot of people in the musicians' in the group's studio that were contributing to the way the group's records sound. I mean, Sgt. Pepper's was, you know, hundreds of people playing.
Right.
And there was, and still to this day, you know, it was generated by, you know, a lot of musicians playing. The notion of four guys playing was really had this tiny little spark that happened from the early 60s, really came to life in 64 on television here, and then and ran through the first, you know, 4 or 5 years of the Beatles being together. And but even when they were together, you know, they were bringing people into play and having, you know, augmenting things and so forth. So that pure Beatles stuff really happened 62, 63, 64, right in there. And you can see some of those old things on YouTube now, blessedly, because you really get to see the power and the wonder of those guys, and you really see what that looks like. But it wasn't widespread. I mean, that wasn't the way it was done. And so when somebody comes up and says, "Well, you know, you guys were not real," that's just not really being in touch with what is real and the way it actually came down.
Well, speaking as a little kid at the time.
How old were you?
I was born in 1955, so I was the prime age for the Monkees.
Yeah, you really were. You were 10 years old.
Yeah. And I loved the Monkees, and I didn't care. I mean, I loved Monkees and more of the Monkees in Headquarters. I didn't see a big difference in those records. I thought they were all great records.
You say it right. You were the prime age. There was another little thing that I handled in the book, which is the double generation gap. The first generation gap happened when the Beatles hit the Ed Sullivan Show, and everybody who was from, you know, 17 to 25 just went crazy. And those were the people that were very upset about the fact that we weren't a band with a television show, that we were a television show about a band. But those people, the 17 to 25-year-old, had siblings, younger siblings, who were 9 to 11. And those people, as you know, as you experienced, loved it. They thought, this is the best thing. And they weren't at all surprised when it started to come to life, started to manifest on this plane. And it was, but it was another generation gap. It was the generation gap between the younger sibling and the older sibling. And it fascinated me that it existed so profoundly, and it's that younger generation gap that persists more today. The older guys have gone on to their trailer parks.
Oh, I had the Monkees 45 of Last Train to Clarksville before the show was ever on the air.
Yeah, I know. It was a big hit. I thought that was a very good record. That was Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, and just a group of great studio players.
Well, I recently saw you and Peter Tork and Mickey Dolenz perform together at the Golden State Theater in Monterey. That was a great night, and you recently completed a new Monkees album. It's called Good Times, and I love that song called Me and Magdalena that you sing on that CD. So what's your relationship now with the other Monkees, and how do you feel about performing or recording with them?
Well, I think it's probably past. It's good. My relationship with them is good. It was always very professional between the four of us, and always distant. I mean, we were never very close friends because we hadn't really grown organically like a lot of rock and roll bands do, where you spend hours and hours a day. I remember Billy Gibbons saying when he first got with Dusty and Frank that they just set up a shuffle and just sat there and played, you know, 24 hours straight. And then, you know, from there they grew into ZZ Top and what they became. And that sort of organic beginning did not happen for the four of us. We went out on an audition call through the regular channels of television and movie production, and up through the chain of audition after audition after audition, and finally, you know, being grouped together slowly and very carefully crafted around the idea of the television show of rock and roll guys on the beach. So it was we never, aside from our professional courtesies and relationships, we never really developed a close or tight bond. I mean, it was never Mick and Keith, you know. It was or John and Paul. It was always, you know, the four of us and the other five or eight people who were helping with the production of the music and so forth.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking today with Mike Nesmith. He's just written an autobiography. It's called Infinite Tuesday, an autobiographical riff. Mike Nesmith, after the Monkees television series was over, the Monkees made a feature-length film directed by Bob Raffleson called Head. I heard Terry Garr say once that the reason the movie was called Head was so that they could, if they ever made a sequel, they could say from the people who gave you Head.
Well, that was, you know, one of the cheaper jokes around. But no, I think they just didn't know quite what to call it. And the idea, you know, the counterculture had this big move from the old industrial revolution and pistons and pulleys and belts and stuff into the new world of thought and information from the, you know, from sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Came the cyber culture, and that's what was going on, and the producers and the six of us, five of us wrote it. We all went to the desert, the four of us and Bert and Bob and Jack, Bert Schneider and Bob Raffleson, Jack Nicholson. We all went out and we just told jokes and smoked dope and laughed and had a good time for 3 or 4 days. And what emerged was something that didn't have much of a narrative structure. It was sort of all over the place, but it really did capture something of the time and something of the way the times were being informed by the new philosophies. You know, by that time we had relativity and quantum mechanics were just starting to emerge, and there were a lot of these ideas that were way past the old Industrial Revolution. And so Head just seemed like a good general catch-all for it. I mean, it was, you know, from the producers who gave you Head, was one of the first jokes to pop up, but, you know, that's the way that goes.
Bristow, in his book about the 70s, movies of the 70s, and he was saying that the producers set out to destroy the Monkees with Head, and that you guys were the unwilling participants. Is there any truth to that?
Well, that was true. I mean, I think that there was an intent to do harm for the careers of the four of us individuals. That was the dark secret in the closet of the whole thing. What nobody realized was that the Monkees were an element of the pop culture. And so when the movie came out, and it came out like the movie it is, it emblazoned the monkeys on the pop culture, became a part of it in a way that not only did it not destroy the careers and not destroy what it was, it made it a permanent fixture. People saw it for, you know, and you look back at it now and you realize, oh, I see, that's what that looked like. And so I think that there was some discussion in the darker corners of the studio about let's just get rid of this whole thing, let's throw it off of a bridge, and then it'll go away and it won't bother any of us. But that didn't happen. Again, the whole Monkees dynamic persisted, and the next thing you know, it was on stage playing.
Yeah, you were saying earlier about what it felt like to sit in the audience and watch them perform and see all the love and devotion. I mean, if you had known in 1970, say, that there would be interest, not only interest, but devotion to a band a half a century later, would that have made a difference to you then?
I think it would have. I was really disappointed that the underlying validity and dynamic of the whole effort was lost on a lot of people. And I kept thinking, if you could see what this is, but you would really love it. But those people, that was because those were my peers. And I, you know, one of the things, who doesn't want the respect of their peers? But it was, we had more the respect of the 10-year-olds and the 9-year-olds. And that was different. Had I known that this was going to be a lifelong, valuable thing, a plant that grew in the forest, I would have enjoyed watching it grow. But it was a feeling that it was going to evaporate. Jagger says these days, he said, we never thought we'd be here. Never thought we'd be playing 55 years after we started. And I think if I had known that, I would have thought of it differently than I did at the time. But I'm glad it worked out like it did.
Yeah, I think as Rhino Records is continuously reissuing the Monkees albums in various box sets and deluxe editions, and then they just put out the Monkees complete series on Blu-ray, which includes a wonderful print of Head. Are you consulted? Do you have anything to do with any of this?
Yeah, I mean, it's keep in mind that the four of us were not creative drivers here, and never were, and still aren't. But we have something to say because all of us have the Queen's veto. All of us can say, well, I don't want to do that, and it immediately explodes the whole effort. So we were very careful about being sure that we're pushing all in the same direction and we have our shoulder to the same wheel and so forth. The thing that is more important than just whether we all work together and make those creative calls, it's easy to see that when a large group gets together around a large idea, big things happen. And that's what happened in the early stages of the Monkees, even though it was started off just as a fairly simple television in the adolescent days of television itself. And so we didn't have a lot to do with the early shows, and we didn't have a lot to do with the way the early records were picked. And like I say, the only album that we made as a foursome was Headquarters, and there was a lot of music that came along after that. But there's something that goes along with these efforts that makes it live on its own. And it's not, I talk to a lot of people who are nosing around and saying, well, how did this happen and who did this and who has the ideas and so forth. This, when you get something that's this size, there's no one person that's responsible for any of it. No two people, no five people. You can't find a creative center or a nexus. It has its own reality, and it creates that reality as it goes along. And so as part of that, I'm really grateful for a seat on the bus, and I have a great seat on the bus. I can see everything and I know everybody. And mm-hmm. But And at the end of the day, there's not a lot for me to say or to do. I mean, I can say I'll do it or I won't do it. That's what I mean by the Queen's veto. But that's not really what you mean by, you know, making creative decisions or choosing the cover for the album or choosing the song to go on it. And this the Good Times album was put together by a coalescing group of pros that are all given credit on the album itself, and all brought a lot to the party. And I made a lot of good friends, good new friends that I've enjoyed knowing.
Well, and I like that record a lot. It's really fun. Was that not a Monkees album? I mean, did you not get into the studio together and make it?
Well, no. I mean, we all played on it, but we played it independently. The only album that we all sat down, the four of us in the studio, was Headquarters.
And none of the other albums that came after that, it never happened again?
Well, those were remnants of Headquarters.
Oh.
And so, yes, there were some of them that had all of us playing, but most of the time they were augmented and built up the way pop records are.
Yeah, sure. Well, let's take us back, Mike Nesmith, if you would, to your life, you know, before the Monkees. So you grew up in Texas.
Well, I'm happy to do it, but I don't know that there's a lot buried there. I grew up in Texas. I was raised by seven women, which I loved, whom I loved. My girlfriend in college got pregnant, so we fled to California because Texas was going to kill us. And I got the job on the Monkees.
Well, you had made records before that. Michael Blessing, right? Wasn't that you?
Well, I was casting about. You know, I was just I was a player and writer and a folk singer on the streets of Hollywood, like so many are.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize I'd sort of gone to the wrong place, but I went there because of the weather.
As opposed to New York, you mean?
Yeah. Had I gone to New York, I think I might have landed in the publishing community and more in the prose community, and might have been a different career path. But when you go to Hollywood, you know, it's television and movies and porno. I mean, that's what goes on.
Did you never made me porno? Did you know?
No. None of us did, as far as I know.
Well, now wait a minute. Mickey Dolenz is in Linda Lovelace for President. I don't know if that's.
Oh, I don't know about that. It seems to me like Mickey said, yeah, he had a picture of him taken having sex sometime. I said, well, Mick, and he said, well, what's wrong with that? I said, well, nothing's wrong with it. He said, everybody has sex. I said, yeah, but everybody doesn't get a picture taken of him after
sex. I love that song, Different Drum, that was recorded by Linda Ronstadt and the Stone Ponies. Was that before the Monkees that record came out?
Yeah, I'd written that with the first publishing deal that I made there, and that was a... part of my folk set. I was writing that semi-country rock folk thing, Different Drum, and Papa Jean's Blues, and Nine Times Blue, and a stack of stuff that came out on the later First National Band albums.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so you were a top-notch songwriter before ever getting involved in the Monkees.
Well, easy going there on top.
Well, wait a minute, what about that one... that the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band did. I love that.
Yeah, well, I had a couple of nice, inside the park home runs, but, the big long ball hitters were much different, and it was a much different time for me. I was a television actor. I was a television actor and musician that had come from singing in a folk group and in a folk club and so forth. It's an unusual way to come up the rungs. But it was, perfectly fine for me, and it paid the bills and fed my children, and that was important.
And then you actually became a performing singer, songwriter, rock and roll star.
Well, I just kept on after the show was off the air. I knew I had to do something, and one of the things I had going on in my head was this music, and I put together a band called the First National Band. We made. Six or seven albums for RCA, and one of them, the first one that came out, had a song on it called Joanne, and it got some traction at the top 40 level, oddly enough, because it's more or less a country ballad.
had a big sticker on the album. Jelly?
Yeah. And so, and those first three albums, it was a trilogy, and that was you know, what I was doing. I was going around playing in that band, but there was not a whole lot of receptivity to that because of the Monkees. You know, people didn't understand why I didn't go out with the Monkees and play. And but you know, Mickey and Peter and Davey were not playing at that point. So Mickey and Davey and I tried to do some dates, but they didn't go well either. I just went off on my own and did the First National Band.
Her name was Joanne, and she lived in a meadow by a pond. And she touched me for a moment with a look that spoke to me of her sweet love. Then the woman that she was drove her on with desperation, and I saw as she went a most hopeless situation for Joanne and the man and the time that made them both run. She was only a girl, I know that well, but still I could not see.
Gary Shapiro, you're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. My guest this week is Michael Nesmith. He's just written his autobiography. It's called Infinite Tuesday, an autobiographical riff. We'll be back with more of our conversation right after this. Michael Nesmith, tell us, how did you go from being a singer-songwriter to being a video entrepreneur?
What happened was, as I mentioned in the book, was a very long and kind of tedious road up the coast. And as the counterculture started turning into the cyberculture, I started to feel the push of that cyberculture, which was, you know, it looked like hippies at the time. But what it was Apple and Facebook and Hewlett-Packard and everybody that created this giant industry that goes up the Northwestern Corridor. And so I began to look at ways of exploring new media and doing different stuff. I wrote a book with a soundtrack called The Prison, which was, you know, multimedia at the same time. And then I wrote an album called Photon Wing, From a Radio Engine to the Photon Wing. And on it was a record called Rio. And the guy who ran the record company, a man named Chris Blackwell, who ran and owned Island Records, said, you know, we have film clips over here. Would you make a film clip for the song Rio? Because if you do, I think you can have a hit record. So I said, well, sure. But I didn't know what he meant by that. I just said, yeah, I'll do it. And he said, well, there's these television programs all over Europe, and if the video clip that you make gets played on one of those music television programs, then, you know, you got a hit record because they're the only source of broadcast here. So go make it and see what you can do. So what he meant was stand up in front of the microphone and sing it like you were, you know, on the stage of a variety show. What I thought he meant and ultimately went and made was a little movie, you know, where you put a bunch of stuff together and it, different scenes, and you render in some degree the spirituality of the song that you're trying to convey through images, and that they come together. So that's what I did. I was friends with a guy named Bill Deere, who was met while we were doing a movie, and my wife at the time, Catherine, was out of the production side of things. And so we put this video together and didn't quite understand how it was going to work. Bill was confused. He was a commercial director. He said, well, I don't see any continuity here. I don't see how this all flows together. And I said, well, I don't either, because I don't understand how to make a film. But what I do understand is that it's all of the same stuff. So it's like, as long as you're putting really high quality ingredients together, you're not exactly sure what you're going to get, but it's going to be high quality, because you're not going to make a mess of it. So what happened while we edited it was we watched as the video became secondary to the audio. And the audio took on the primary function of driving the narrative. And the videos augmented that. And as that happened, the fact that the images were discontinuous made almost no difference at all. And it was the continuity of the music and the continuity of the audio that just stunned us all. We were in a big edit facility, and pretty soon everybody in all the other edit bays were coming over to this room that we were working in, saying, my gosh, what is this thing? What is this thing? And I said, I don't know. I just made it up. I'm doing it to take over to England. So after I put it together and I showed it to a few people, everybody said, this is extraordinary. I haven't seen anything like this. And I went over to England, and there was a gathering of the promotion men who were to take these film clips around to get, you know, state television in Italy and Spain and France and Portugal to play. And they were all looking at the new videos that came in, and I snuck in and was in the control room of this big studio. And I watched, there's about 30 or 40 guys in there, men and women, I think. And when Rio came on, they were all bored. You know, just one person singing their song after another. And then when Rio came on, the place went electric. And when it was over, people stood up and cheered and were clapping each other high fives. And I was sort of embarrassed, but it was really an electric moment, almost like when we had edited it. And what had happened in that time was, without any conscious effort on my part, was the birth of the music video. Nobody else was doing this at the time, or the people that were doing, we were so far off in the margins, or an effort like this was in the margins, and nobody understood how this thing was coming together. But at that point, when everybody was cheering in the control room, I realized, wow, this is something very powerful. And I went back and I showed it to a bunch of people, and everybody said, this is great, but what are you going to do with this thing? Because in the United States, there was not the same kind of distribution that they had in Europe, where there was a state-owned television station that would control the audience and play these promotional clips, as they were called. And I said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to look around. And I was driving along, actually, down Carmel Valley Road, and I thought, now, what is this thing? If this is a video record, which is kind of what I was thinking of it as, how does an audio record get played so that people can hear it? Well, it's on radio. There's a symbiotic relationship between an audio record and radio. And so what is the relationship between a video record and television? I said, oh, of course, a television. So the question was, could you set up a television station to play music videos? And would there be any music videos? And I was making a little bit of a living, you know, I'd go out and I'd play songs and so forth, but this began to take over my life. And through some quirks and twists and stuff that came along, I called up some old friends of mine and one of my buddies that we'd been making music down in L.A. said, you know, you ought to call Warner Brothers, because they're involved with American Express in this pilot program, didn't work, and now they've got a satellite sitting up in the sky that's costing them $12 million a year in rent, and they don't have anything to put on it. And maybe this is programming for something like that. So I went back to New York, and I showed them Rio, and I talked down the idea for a 24-hour cable television, and thus was born MTV. And they bought it from me, and I came back to Carmel and made, we made about, I think, 10 or 12 half-hour programs that we then tested, and those 12 programs turned into like 50. You know, you chopped them up and played them around in different places. And that was played on Nickelodeon, and the reaction was astounding. It just pinned the meter. went all the way to the end and stayed there. And they said, well, we want to do this. Will you come back and run the programming service for us? And I thought about that, and I thought, no, you know, I really don't want to be a cable television guy. And I couldn't see much past what this would be for cable television. I knew it was a billion-dollar idea, but I didn't, you know, understand exactly how it was going to happen or how it would be distributed or any of those things. Didn't understand the technologies and what Warner Amex were swinging at. So a guy named John Lack was my contact there, and a couple of execs. And he took it over and ran with it. They put $55 million into it, and that became MTV. But I spun off, and I stayed in Carmel, Monterey, and I continued to do stuff. And my mother died in 1980 and left me a fortune, and so I decided I would take it and make movies. And one of the first movies I made was a movie called Time Rider, which Bill Deere and I wrote. And then the second movie I wrote was called Repo Man, which was a kind of a cult hit. And then the third movie I wrote and did was a movie called Tapeheads with John Cusack and Tim Robbins.
Some classic films there.
Yeah, they were some good times. And then I closed down Pacific Arts for movies, and I just thought, I'm just going to distribute stuff. And I got into the distribution business. I got into the video distribution business in the 80s and hit a very strange patch, because I made a deal with PBS to use their logo to distribute this line, and PBS got it in their mind that they wanted to see if they could steal my catalog from me. And so that ended up in a lawsuit, which I won. And
we often hear of the evil corporate conglomerates coming to get the little man, but you didn't expect it to be PBS coming.
No. My joke was, I won that lawsuit, and the jury awarded me $48 million, and because of that, it was the largest award in California that year, and made the cover of the law magazines, and I got a lot of people calling up and said, "What do you think of this? What about somebody like that trying to steal this stuff?" And I said, "Well, it's it's always good if somebody steals your stereo to get it back, but it's really heartbreaking when you find out that it was your grandmother that stole the stereo." And so that was, kind of put me in a position where I didn't have to work and could pick and choose what I wanted to do. And I developed a technology, which is just really a process for virtual reality, in 06, and built it out. And then in 07, I went through a divorce, and then in 2012, I was awarded the patent for that thing that I built for the virtual reality and virtual worlds. And so that pretty well brings us up to now.
And your book, which I thought was an amazing book.
Yeah, I sat down and wrote Infinite Tuesday and put it all in a book. You don't have to read it now. I told you the whole story.
No, there's so much in it that you haven't told us. But I want to know, is there more? I mean, there's a lot of stuff in your life that you don't talk about in Infinite Tuesday. Is there going to be Infinite Tuesday, Infinite part, continuum?
Infinite Wednesday. I don't know. I don't have anything unsaid that I want to have said, but maybe, I love writing. Writing is my first craft, so I wish I had more of it to do, and I'm just kind of looking for the right next step. I think if I can get a video ranch, VR3D, to land, and get that service up and going, I'll probably back way off and go on a writer's sabbatical and see what I can put together.
Well, I loved The Prison. That was one of my favorite things.
Oh, thanks.
I had a little, came in like a box set and had the book and the record.
Yeah.
That was very groovy.
Yeah, good.
Well, Mike Nesmith, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, it's my pleasure. Always glad to get out and stump the top books a little bit, see what happens. I appreciate your interest and your taking the time.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Michael Nesmith. His new book is an autobiography. It's called Infinite Tuesday, an autobiographical riff. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.